coming to Berkeley is kind of a test of every politician. In the year 1967, 68, I was here earlier this year and passed through almost unnoticed, which is kind of a shock, or at least it was to me. So I dared to come back. It was rather a bad day, and there wasn't much of an announcement of my coming. I don't know whether this is the exact moment, but I do think that the campaign of 1968 is beginning on the college campuses in the fall of 1967. And I think this is the right place for it to come, because the nature of the political problems with which we're going to have to deal, with which we are trying to deal, both domestic and foreign, I think present a very special kind of challenge to three groups in our society: the scholars, or the intellectuals, if we can use that term, the moral and religious leaders of the country, and also in a very particular way, the young people of America. And when they combine, as you do, both youth and at least an aspiration for scholarship, your responsibility is, by virtue of that, a kind of double responsibility. And the reason for this is that the issues which face us do require a greater searching, really, of intellect and knowledge. They require a deep moral commitment, and because they relate really to a projection into the future in hope, they involve very deeply and intimately all of the young people of America. The issues that I had to deal with when I was on the campus in the 30s called for something of the same commitment. And that period of the Depression was one in which, for the first time really in the at least modern history in America, the intellectuals were called into politics, or were called to politics. Because here we found ourselves in the midst of a depression, with half of our workmen out of work, with agriculture suffering from poverty, with the whole economy stopped, and that all that was offered was a kind of deterministic explanation for what had happened, a suggestion that this was the way the business cycle ran, and you had to wait for some kind of recovery. It was as though we were subject to natural forces, or to the phases of the moon, or to the rotation of the earth, but no one was supposed to make any kind of rational judgment about the American political or economic system. And of course, this became intolerable, and we did begin to look at America in terms of possibly working out some theories about what ought to be done, and having done that, to proceed to work out some practical programs. And this was the substance, it was really rather simple, some of the proposals, that what made up the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. And we pursued that on through the 30s, and then with the interruption of World War II, through the 40s and on through until about the 88th and the 89th Congress, when we finally acted upon a legislative program which the country had needed for 40 years. We passed legislation extending aid to education to the country. We finally passed a medical care program for the aged. We finally acted upon the civil rights program. We began to do something about an immigration act which had been out of date for 60 years. All of these calling for a kind of limited commitment of the intellect, but not very much. You didn't have to be very intelligent, for example, to know that we needed a better system of aid to education in the year 1948, say nothing of 1966. You didn't have to really be very intelligent to see that we needed some kind of medical care for the aged in this country in the year 1966. Although it was hard for some people, we had a group of undertakers who testified against it. On the grounds that it would disturb the traditional doctor-patient relationship. We suggest to them, if they could just stand the slowdown for a while, that eventually that everyone would come to them. The same was true of civil rights. The early civil rights legislation was clear under the Constitution. You didn't have to be a great constitutional lawyer or a great student of history in order to realize that everyone in this country was guaranteed the right to vote and due process of law. But as we move on from these achievements, to deal with the problems today, first the domestic one, the problem of poverty, you have a problem which is much more difficult to understand, which requires a much greater commitment of the mind, because it's much more complicated, involving history and psychology and many other forces that run in our society. It's much more difficult to understand the new civil rights that we're talking about in the United States, some of them arising from redefinition of the old ones. The right of freedom of speech, for example, requires new definition and new understanding today. The right of freedom of assembly is something very different from what it was certainly in 1789 and very different from what it was in the 30s, when really all we were talking about was the right of labor to organize. The right of freedom of worship is much more complicated and more difficult to explain and to understand today. The right of privacy, which when it was first written into the Constitution really was limited almost to keeping the government from quartering troops in your house, now reaches out to involve all of the most sophisticated kinds of electronic and other devices for spying upon or intruding into your private life. The new economics is much more difficult to understand than even the simple theories that were advanced back in the New Deal days. But it's not just a demand on the intellect. We can, in almost every one of these areas, come to as much knowledge as is available, make the best kind of judgment about the problem, but we then come up to an edge where we have to take one or two steps in uncertainty. And this is the point at which we're called upon to make a moral commitment. We're called upon to make a moral commitment with reference to poverty, for example, because no one is ever going to come to a full understanding of it and know that every program is going to be a success or even be able to measure the success. The new areas of civil rights, as we move into the field of housing, for example, as distinguished from the right to vote, or job equality, or the integration of our communities, these are not problems which lend themselves to a simple kind of intellectual solution following which everyone will conform. But they're problems which, after we've inquired and reasoned about them, we're called upon to make, in addition, a deep and a continuing kind of moral commitment. And the same is true with reference to foreign policy, which is really the particular point of my talk to you here tonight, not just with reference to Vietnam, but that we try to encompass and make some kind of projection as to what the role of America will be throughout the rest of this century and on into the century beyond. It's my judgment that you could make a case for a limited involvement in Vietnam when we sent in advisors, and for the kind of protection which was given to those advisors by President Kennedy, but that we reached a point in the escalation of the war at which a quantitative standard had to be applied, in which it was no longer possible to say that there was a justifiable proportion between the commitment of life and property and moral energy to the war in Vietnam and the possible good that might come with victory. And so, as I see it, we have reached a point, really now, I think we reached it at least a year ago, in which you could no longer morally justify what we were doing in Vietnam, certainly not the escalation of the war, in which you could not make a legal case for it, and certainly it appears also that you could not even make a military case for our involvement there. And if one wanted to add a fourth judgment, not a political case, because as we moved along month after month, those nations which had perhaps given us honest support or at least lip support began to draw away. And this is a serious loss for the United States, because we were founded really in the appeal of the Declaration of Independence when we said that what we were doing we wanted to have approved by the decent opinion of mankind. And so today, some 180 years later, I think we still have an obligation to be concerned and to seek to conform in some degree to what the decent opinion of mankind is with reference to our involvement in Vietnam. It's not that we can always depend on other nations to tell us what to do, but there does come a time when this kind of collective judgment, the judgment of the people, must be sought out, and we should seek it out, if we're not clear as to what it is now, in the United Nations and by every other possible instrumentality or channel that is available to us. My special concern over the last few weeks has been with what, of course, has been in evidence for a long time, a kind of continuous expansion and escalation of the war. And it's rather curious, I think, that more and more, as the war has become more involved and difficult to explain, that the Pentagon has begun to use Latin words. Now, this is not necessarily bad, but George Orwell, writing in 1946 about the Russians and the Hungarian revolt and some of their activities, pointed out that it was very convenient to use a Latin word to more or less obscure things which were very unpleasant. He described then what was called pacification. He said all this means is that you machine gun the villages, you drive the people out into the roads, you burn the houses, and this you call pacification. It has almost direct application to, at least in use as we apply it today. He gave some other examples, rectification of boundaries, and he didn't list the word which is most popular today in the lexicon of our administration, escalation. Escalation, a Latin word which is presented to us almost as though it freed anyone who was involved in the decision-making from personal responsibility. So this was something which was happening to you, and you could at no point cut it off. There's always too early or too late. It's a kind of continuum. There's no point at which the escalator stops. So if you say, well, we might have done that then, but we've passed that point, and we might do it in the future, but not now. This is always the wrong time to suspend bombing or to use the enclave concept of General Gavin, whatever the particular proposition might be. But about a month ago, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. McNamara, announced that we were putting in what he called a thin anti-ballistic missile system. But he said that this would be pointed at China. This was supposedly to reassure the Russians and also to reassure us. That, I thought, was the beginning of a kind of attempt to transfer, really, the case for the war and to present it to us on a much broader base. But about 2 weeks ago, the Secretary of State at a press conference talked about, well, he protests. He said that we're trying to inject racism into this war because several people have suggested that what he proposed or what he raised was a kind of yellow peril. Well, I think he did. I mean, he talked about the fact that we were going to have 1 billion Chinese in 1 or 2 decades from now and that they would be armed with nuclear weapons. The impression was that each one would somehow have one. I see it. Now, I suggested in the answer that we had nearly 200 million Americans, but only one of us had the nuclear weapon, and that the same might be true of the Chinese. He went on to say quite clearly that those who really suggested that there ought to be a change in policy might well be putting this nation in mortal danger. But if you put all of these things together and suggest that this is not very different from the old yellow peril, it seems to me that his protest must suggest that we don't really understand what he's saying. And it's not really a credibility gap, but a kind of incredibility gap. And we keep trying to break through it. And the impression you get is, one of my colleagues said, he said, you know, trying to analyze this administration is like trying to write a review of an accordion concert. What you have going on in this is a kind of, well, as I see it, the danger is that in the Rusk remarks is that with 500,000 men in South Vietnam and $3 billion a month being spent on it, old explanation, we were there simply to stabilize South Vietnam, and then, having done that, to build a society, that this was an objective which was not proportionate to the physical effort and expenditure that we were making. So, in order to put things back in balance, you have to escalate the objective so that instead of South Vietnam, we are now saving all of Southeastern Asia. And you can then say, well, 500,000 men to save Southeastern Asia, there's a proportion in this case, and maybe you need 1,000,000 men. And then you put in 1,000,000, and maybe 1.5 million as this progresses. And at that point, even saving Southeastern Asia is not proportionate to 1.5 million men and what goes with it. So then they may have to make the ultimate escalation to develop a kind of confrontation with the Red Chinese. And I think that this is the time, in the months from now until the Democratic Convention, and possibly beyond that, in which this whole question has to be put to the test. And it's my judgment that the real political test, if it can be successfully carried out, at least it must be made, we must try to make it, is within the context of the Democratic Party itself. I say this for two or three reasons. One, I think this is a test of the process of democracy. Maybe it won't work. Maybe there's no way in which the people can somehow have their judgment manifest in American politics on an issue of this kind. But I think it's an issue which is of this nature, that the national chairman of my party, Mr. Bailey, called for unity about a month ago, and nearly every administration spokesman has called for it, the president, the secretary of state, the vice president, who made the civil rights speech in 1948 when there were those who said we ought to have unity. They call for unity now when on the record, you know, so far as I know, and I've been in politics for 20 years and remember a few conventions beyond that, the call for unity in the Democratic Party has never been made until about the second or third day of a national convention. And oftentimes, not until two or three days after. So to come a year before the elections and 8 months or so before the convention and call for unity is clearly contrary to the traditions of the Democratic Party. And I think we must put this to the test. It's not a case to be settled by the judges or by the lawyers in chamber. This is the kind of case which, in law, you would take to the jury. To have the jury, which is the people of the country, make some kind of determination as to what commitment they want the United States to make or in what way they want the United States committed. And those of us who are in politics have the responsibility of trying to establish the means whereby that kind of jury judgment can be passed upon this vital and crucial issue. Well, you say, what about the Republicans? Well, there's not much in the record, and I don't really mean to be partisan, but there's not much in the record that would lead us to believe that there's going to be a test of it in that party, nor that if we come to the showdown in November that they'll be offering any kind of reasonable alternative to what may be offered along the way in the fight within the Democratic Party. For the most part, Republicans have encouraged President Johnson as he's moved along the way of escalation. Some of them have charged that he wasn't doing enough. One or two have said we ought to turn more of this operation over to the military establishment. The liberal Republicans stand aside. Well, they're a little bit, you can tell when the battle is over with them. At that point, they usually go down and shoot the wounded men. And then they say, look, we were very humane, and we ended the fight. But I don't see how you can find in that movement in the Republican Party that the kind of forceful movement and leadership and concentration of effort on this issue that I think is necessary for the country. I would suggest that this is where you ought to turn your attention as the campaign does develop. I'm hopeful that we can do some things before the campaign, in the Congress and outside. But I do think this is the ultimate test in our society, and it's a test that can come really effectively only every 4 years. We do not have built into our system the potential to bring down the government. It might be good if we did, or if we could And we can't even give it a very good shape, excepting in the off-presidential elections, and then it's ordinarily limited to domestic issues. But in hearings on the Fulbright resolution some 6 weeks ago, the Undersecretary of State, Mr. Katzenbach, came up to give the administration position. And in the course of his case before the Senate committee, he said some rather interesting things. He said that the Constitution compelled the Congress to support administration foreign policy without telling just how this was to be done or where it was compelled. He said we had power under the Constitution to frustrate and obstruct foreign policy, but said nothing about our having the right and the duty to influence foreign policy. And he said that it was a good thing when circumstances permitted that the Congress and the executive branch of the government agree on foreign policy. Well, that seemed bad enough. And finally, he quoted Thomas Jefferson in support of his position for a strong executive. And that was too much even for the limited scholars in the Senate, because we knew that Thomas Jefferson was on our side and that he was against this sort of thing. Well, this, an administration position, which if you analyze it, if this is what they really believe, was nothing short really of a kind of prescription for a 4-year, you'd hope, benevolent kind of dictatorship in foreign policy. And no reason to believe that what Katzenbach had to say did not represent the position of the administration, because it was a formal case. It was not a kind of press conference situation. He came up with a prepared statement in which this kind of language and this interpretation of the Constitution and the role of the Senate and the Congress in the determination of foreign policy was laid before us. So we can protest along the way, as we have this year, fighting the independence of the CIA, putting limits upon the Defense Department and its freedom of operation, and challenging in debate as best we can. But I think that the best thing that could be done, and the president were to ask me, I would suggest this to him, it would accomplish certain things. It would indicate at least a possibility of a change in policy with reference to Vietnam. It would suggest to the country that we might be somewhat more open to negotiations than we now are. It would, I think, help to close the gap of credibility or lack of confidence in the administration with reference to this war. It would certainly improve relationships between the Senate and the executive branch of the government. And that would be a rather quiet resignation on the part of the Secretary of State. I look at this one. Following that, we could look at some of the other cabinet members, but I think So whether that happens or not, we have to proceed in what I think is the orderly and proper political way to begin to raise this issue in the framework of the political parties of the country, and this means principally the Democratic Party. We have to be prepared to send instructed delegates to the Democratic National Committee if one has it within his power to influence those choices. We should be prepared to support favorite sons who may be committed to a position on Vietnam and on some other issues that also concern me in the country. And be prepared, I think, also where there are primaries, to support those men who may be willing to carry the flag against an incumbent president of the United States. I think that all of us occasionally have to reflect upon the way in which we use the possessive. I understand that among the youngest generation that the word my is more or less out. You either use a possessive our or no possessive, which has a lot to recommend it. But in some of the older generations, the problem is that they use the word the possessive as though it applied in the same way to every object. Whether you're talking about my dog or my vice president or my car. My party or my farm, or I think I better stop the list now. That the process of democracy here is that every 4 years we're called upon to look to the choice of the President of the United States, not just the country as a whole, but particularly the political parties have the primary responsibility. And so in this particular campaign as we approach it, let me repeat what I said at the beginning. There's a special burden and challenge which rests upon the scholars and the educated and the intellectuals of America because of the nature of the problem, domestic and international, which involves a great judgment of history, the movement of history itself. There's a great responsibility upon everyone who claims to give any moral direction to decisions in America, because the moral component of this decision is a vital one. There's a great burden upon the young people of this country, because what we're asking for is a kind of commitment in hope to the future. And so we need to call upon you to participate in the decision as to whether or not you're prepared to take some chances on the side of trust and on the side of confidence in the future, whether we deal with domestic problems or with international problems, including the Chinese, or whether you wish to be committed to what seems to be the policy of most political leaders in this country, one of suspicion and of narrow self-seeking and of lack of confidence in the future, which means lack of confidence in you. Thank you.
Time to take a few questions from the audience.
What alternative do we have? Well, I don't know if you ought to settle on a particular candidate. I think people who are active in politics, or even those who hold office, if they feel very seriously about this issue, have a responsibility of taking some chances. And I see the possibility of favorite sons or politicians urging instructed delegations or uninstructed delegations if they wish. And that I think we may have to anticipate as this developed a confrontation involving personalities in some of the primaries. I'm not prepared to nominate anybody here today, but I think that this should be, that we have to establish that this responsibility does exist, and that there come certain times in politics when the individual, I don't think, really has the right to anticipate how things are going to be better for him in 72. But honestly, I'll be careful what I say. Well, that's a pretty hypothetical question, because it's rather difficult to say. I think that the vice president, I really lost interest, or at least kind of took myself out of that contest at Atlantic City, some of you may remember, with I may be oversimple. There were a number of considerations, but my explanation was that when the president said he meant to give new meaning to the office, that I decided that I wasn't interested. That I thought that the old kind of vice presidency was what I was really seeking, and I think this is a better way to have it. A vice president really ought to stand by and keep healthy. Well, that's a rather difficult question, too, because it depends upon whom the Republicans are running. And as I see it, those that are in the contest now, I think that the choice of President Johnson against any one of them would not be too difficult. In the case of Ronald Reagan, you know, you kind of have him intercepting all of our mail. And Rockefeller has, all along the way, has supported and even urged more vigorous action in Vietnam. Nixon was for intervention there in 1954. And if we say about Romney, he's been in the automobile industry so long that he realizes the value of changing models as often as you have to in order to sell cars, so that you don't have really among those who are being offered this. For this reason, I say I think that the test and the effort must be made along the way between now and the convention next summer in the Democratic Party. You're starting rather, you know, I don't want to leave out anybody who might be more deserving. But starting kind of from the top down, I would say, I'd name three or four, I think, whom I would suggest. Douglas Dillon, who was in the Kennedy administration as Secretary of the Treasury and was an ambassador. I think I could name two senators. I think Senator Mansfield or Senator John Sherman Cooper, a Republican. At least those three. I could, if they were all rejected, I could send them three more. Yes, sir. Oh, the question of a professional army is against a draft or a subscription. Well, I do have. I don't think that a professional army is particularly desirable. I think that if we had a professional army, which we come very close to having, it makes it much easier for those who are not subject to being included in the army to approve of military ventures, which, if the whole populace is somehow likely to be involved, would move them to pass a somewhat more reserved judgment on the war itself. For example, if we had a professional army today instead of subscription and draft, I have a feeling that public disposition to be continuously critical of the war might not be as clear as it is. And I think that you have to anticipate that the kind of wars which call for a draft, and they're of that size, that we really ought to keep the professional army at a minimum. That's my general position. I say there's very serious problems about the draft. I don't think that the Congress did a proper job in revising the draft this year, nor does the administration in interpreting that revision. If you got into a very difficult problem, well, this is a whole complicated question, but in World War I and World War II, it was just generally assumed that the war was defensible on rational ground, that you couldn't say just in a non-religious examination, I can't make a case against World War I or World War II. So the basis for a draft deferment then was that you had to approve some kind of religious opposition to war, or if you were opposed to war, every kind of war, just and unjust alike. I think you had to prove a religious belief. And that in itself really is unconstitutional. So the basis of draft exemptions on have always been unconstitutional. So when you come to this war, people make the constitutional case, I think, saying even the religious, those who were Quakers and had a religious case, would say we don't want to use that. But we feel that passing a reasoned judgment upon this war, we conclude that simply within that kind of limited judgment, it's not defensible or not justified. Which should be the only basis really upon which an exemption might be granted. But for practical reasons as well, I think there was some failure to examine as thoroughly as they might have into to establish standards upon which a rational objection might have been recognized. But this was the contradiction in which the people working on the draft were caught, and in a way it's a contradiction in which we're all caught. But it raises a most serious moral question and a serious question about future draft laws and subscription and the recruiting of manpower for America. Yes, sir. Pick one out. All right. Yes. Well, let me say this, that I'm not sure. The nature of the war is such that I don't feel that we ought to put the burden of decision upon individual conscience. That this is why I think that men in public office have to speak out to try to change the course of the war, and religious and moral leaders have to speak out. I don't think the issues are quite clear enough to say that generally speaking, individual conscience should be called upon to make the hard decision. There are cases in which it is made, and these people, I think, deserve more protection. But I think my position is that I would probably demonstrate and protest up to the induction center. But at that point, I think that the question is invalid. It may not remain that way, you know, if we continue to escalate and extend the war is now being recommended. But I think the burden of conscience still rests primarily upon those of us who hold public office to try to work it out so that the individuals are not called upon to demonstrate really heroic virtue in the fulfillment of what they think are their civic responsibilities. Yes, sir. Well, I'm not sure that Bobby is going to wait until 72, and there may be others who will challenge. I think that really a kind of broader challenge, at least at this stage of the campaign, is much preferred to a kind of individual challenge, or a grasping of the banner and an effort to rally people around. But as I say, I think everyone in high office in the Democratic Party has to at least theoretically accept that there may be a call that he may have to answer. Yes, sir. All right. One or two more questions. All right. Sorry, we'll take you. So go ahead. Well, I think there might be an independent peace caucus, but I don't think that that's the desirable, should not be the target now, that the effort should be to make it work within the process itself. Well, it might happen. I mean, this might be the contest, you know, but to have an independent caucus in advance of a convention, or to start an independent peace party at this time, I mean, if it was short run, it might be all right. But to look upon this as the answer, I think, would be to refuse to consider the possibility or to make the effort within the processes of politics, which I think still leaves some devices open to people who may change this policy and influence the convention. Yes, sir. Well, yes, I do. In the foreign aid bill this year, we have set a limitation of $50 million on arms sales and arms distribution in Latin America, and $25 million on arms sales and arms distribution in Africa. And overall, we reduced the military, I hope this stands in conference, we reduced the military grant program in the foreign aid bill from something like $571 million to, I think, $320 or $30 million. And we also removed from the Department of Defense the revolving fund that they have been using as a basis for underwriting credit for arms sales. Its potential is $300 and some million. We have provided that it will disappear as the payments come in. So that, taken all together, I think we probably reduce the potential for arms sales and distribution next year by our Defense Department, either directly or indirectly, from about $1.5 billion to $1 billion. Well, this is kind of non-selective and somewhat irrational. The Secretary of Defense said that our action was irrational. When we asked him whether he would prefer to have us act rationally and decide on the specific countries to which the aid should go, he said he would rather have us act irrationally as we had. So it's in that area. But this is a matter of concern. And let me, oh, you've got to get on, finish on this one note. But I think part of our problem in Vietnam, apart from a policy decision, comes from the great strength of the Defense Department, the tremendous power it has. And in part, I think the Secretary of Defense bears some responsibility, but almost any Secretary of Defense would be subject to the same kind, I think, of a kind of pressure. With that tremendous power, if a question is put to the Defense Department as to whether or not they can win or accomplish a military objective, whatever it may be, you say, can you program us victory in South Vietnam by Christmas in 1965? Or Southeastern Asia, or whatever it may be, they're inclined to say, well, you know, give us a few days to study it. And when they study it, they come back and say, well, we can do it. And they think they can. So this tremendous power in itself becomes a force, really, which influences the policy decision itself. And you then reach a point where you don't really raise a question about the program, you're just so pleased with the program. And having approved that, then there's a kind of inevitability about putting the program into effect because you've more or less been assured that the objective can be accomplished. So this is part of the total problem, really the kind of democratic control, and really ties into what I say goes beyond Vietnam. The question that we're really debating here is a kind of projection of American foreign policy over the next 40, 50, or 100 years, in which I think we're called upon for the first time to make a kind of decision as to whether or not we conceive of our role as a kind of continuous performance demonstration that we can police the planet, or whether we're prepared to try to direct it by way of the influence of our ideas and of our non-military potential. This is the substance, I think, of the greater debate than Vietnam, in which we're all pretty deeply involved today. Thank you.